Disc 3.
Chapter 7. The inquest, when it was held, was short and disappointing. Evidence of identification was given by the husband, and the only other evidence was medical. Heather Badcock had died as a result of 4 grains of high ethyl dexyl barbiquindilorotate, or, let's be frank, some such name. There was no evidence to show how the drug was administered. The inquest was adjourned for a fortnight. After it was concluded, Detective Inspector Frank Cornish joined Arthur Badcock.
"Could I have a word with you, Mr. Badcock?"
"Of course, of course." Arthur Badcock looked more like a chewed-out bit of string than ever. I can't understand it," he muttered. "I simply can't understand it."
"I've got a car here," said Cornish. "We'll drive back to your house, shall we? Nicer and more private there."
"Thank you, sir. Yes, yes, I'm sure that would be much better."
They drew up at the neat little blue-painted gate of number 3, Arlington Close. Arthur Badcock led the way, and the inspector followed him. He drew out his latchkey, but before he had inserted it into the door, it was opened from inside. The woman who opened it stood back, looking slightly embarrassed. Arthur Badcock looked startled. "Mary?" he said.
"I was just getting you ready some tea, Arthur. I thought you'd need it when you came back from the inquest."
"Well, that's very kind of you, I'm sure," said Arthur Badcock gratefully. He hesitated. "This is Inspector Cornish. Mrs. Bain. She's a neighbour of mine."
"I see," said Inspector Cornish.
"I'll get another cup," said Mrs. Bain.
She disappeared, and rather doubtfully Arthur Badcock showed the inspector into the bright cretonne-covered sitting room to the right of the hall.
She's very kind," said Arthur Badcock. "Very kind, always."
"You've known her a long time?"
"Oh, no. Only since we came here."
"You've been here 2 years, I believe, or is it 3?
"It's just about 3 now," said Arthur. "Mrs. Bain only got here 6 months ago," he explained. "Her son works near here, and so, after her husband's death, she came down to live here, and he boards with her."
Mrs. Bain appeared at this point, bringing the tray from the kitchen. She was a dark, rather intense-looking woman of about 40 years of age. She had gypsy colouring that went with her dark hair and eyes. There was something a little odd about her eyes. They had a watchful look. She put down the tray on the table, and Inspector Cornish said something pleasant and non-committal. Something in him, some professional instinct, was on the alert. The watchful look in the woman's eyes, the slight start she had given when Arthur introduced him, had not passed unnoticed. He was familiar with that slight uneasiness in his presence, the kind of natural alarm and distrust of those who might have offended unwittingly against the majesty of the law. But there was a second kind, and it was the second kind that he felt sure was present here. Mrs. Bain, he thought, had had at some time some connection with the police, something that had left her wary and ill at ease. He made a mental note to find out a little more about Mary Bain. Having set down the tea tray and refused to partake herself, saying she had to get home, she departed.
"Seems a nice woman," said Inspector Cornish.
"Yes, indeed. She's very kind, a very good neighbour, a very sympathetic woman," said Arthur Badcock.
"Was she a great friend of your wife?"
"No. No, I wouldn't say that. They were neighbourly and on pleasant terms. Nothing special about it, though."
"I see. Now, Mr. Badcock, We want as much information as we can from you. The findings of the inquest have been a shock to you, I expect.
Oh, they have, Inspector. Of course, I realized that you must think something was wrong, and I almost thought so myself, because Heather has always been such a healthy woman. Practically never a day's illness. I said to myself, there must be something wrong. But it seems so incredible, if you understand what I mean, Inspector. I'm really quite incredible. What is this stuff, this biethyl X? He came to a stop.
There is an easier name for it, said the Inspector. It's sold under a trade name. The trade name of Calmo. Ever come across it?
Arthur Badcock shook his head, perplexed.
It's more used in America than here, said the Inspector. They prescribe it very freely over there, I understand.
What's it for?
It induces, or so I understand, a happy and tranquil state of mind, said Cornish. It's prescribed for those under strain, suffering anxiety, depression, melancholy, sleeplessness, and a good many other things. The properly prescribed dose is not dangerous, but overdoses are not to be advised. It would seem that your wife took something like 6 times the ordinary dose.
Badcock stared. Heather never took anything like that in her life, he said. I'm sure of it. She wasn't one for taking medicines anyway. She was never depressed or worried. She was one of the most cheerful women you could possibly imagine.
The Inspector nodded.
I see. And no doctor had prescribed anything of this kind for her.
No, certainly not. I'm sure of that.
Who was her doctor?
She was on Dr. Sims' panel, but I don't think she's been to see him once since we've been here.
Inspector Cornish said thoughtfully,
So she doesn't seem the kind of woman to have been likely to need such a thing, or to have taken it.
She didn't, Inspector, I'm sure she didn't. She must have taken it by a mistake of some kind.
It's a very difficult mistake to imagine, said Inspector Cornish. What did she have to eat and drink that afternoon?
Well, let me see. For lunch?
You needn't go back as far as lunch, said Cornish. Given in such quantity, the drug would act quickly and suddenly. Tea. Go back to tea.
Well, we went into the marquee in the grounds. It was a terrible scrum in there, but we managed in the end to get a bun each and a cup of tea. We finished it as quickly as possible because it was very hot in the marquee, and we came out again.
And that's all she had? A bun and a cup of tea there?
That's right, sir.
And after that, you went into the house. Is that right?
Yes. The young lady came and said that Miss Marina Gregg would be very pleased to see my wife if she would like to come into the house. Well, of course, my wife was delighted. She'd been talking about Marina Gregg for days. Everybody was excited. Oh, well, you know that, Inspector, as well as anyone does.
Yes, indeed, said Cornish. My wife was excited, too. Why, from all around, people were paying their shilling to go in and see Gossington Hall and what had been done there, and hope to catch a glimpse of Marina Gregg herself.
The young lady took us into the house, said Arthur Badcock, and up the stairs. That's where the party was, on the landing up there. But it looked quite different from what it used to look like, so I understand. It was more like a room, a sort of big hollowed-out place with chairs and tables with drinks on them. There were about 10 or 12 people there, I suppose.
Inspector Cornish nodded.
And you were received there... By whom?
By Miss Marina Gregg herself. Her husband was with her. I've forgotten his name now.
Jason Rudd, said Inspector Cornish.
Oh, yes, not that I noticed him at first. Well, anyway, Miss Gregg greeted Heather very nicely and seemed very pleased to see her. And Heather was talking and telling a story of how she'd once met Miss Gregg years ago in the West Indies. And everything seemed as right as rain.
Everything seemed as right as rain, echoed the inspector. And then?
And then Miss Gregg said, what would we have? And Miss Gregg's husband, Mr. Rudd, got Heather a kind of cocktail, a dickery or something like that.
A daiquiri.
That's right, sir. He brought two, one for her and one for Miss Gregg.
And you, what did you have?
I had a sherry.
I see. And you three stood there drinking together.
Well, not quite like that. You see, there were more people coming up the stairs. There was the mayor, for one, and some other people, an American gentleman and lady, I think. So we moved off a bit.
And your wife drank her daiquiri then?
Well, no, not then she didn't.
Well, if she didn't drink it then, when did she drink it? Arthur Badcock stood frowning in remembrance.
I think she set it down on one of the tables. She saw some friends there. I think it was someone to do with the St. John ambulance who'd driven over there from Much Benham or somewhere like that. Anyway, they got to talking together.
And when did she drink her drink?
Arthur Badcock again frowned. It was a little after that, he said. It was getting rather more crowded by then. Somebody jogged Heather's elbow, and her glass got spilt.
What's that? Inspector Cornish looked up sharply. Her glass was spilt?
Yes, that's how I remember it. She'd picked it up, and I think she took a little sip and made rather a face. She didn't really like cocktails, you know, but all the same, she wasn't going to be down by that. Anyway, as she stood there, somebody jogged her elbow and the glass spilled over. It went down her dress, and I think it went down Miss Gregg's dress, too. Well, Miss Gregg couldn't have been nicer. She said it didn't matter at all, and it would make no stain, and she gave Heather her handkerchief to wipe up Heather's dress, and then she passed over the drink she was holding and said, have this, I haven't touched it yet.
She handed over her own drink, did she? Said the inspector. You're quite sure of that?
Arthur Badcock paused a moment while he thought. Yes, I'm quite sure of that, he said.
And your wife took the drink?
Well, she didn't want to at first, sir. She said, oh, no, I couldn't do that, and Miss Gregg laughed and said, I've had far too much to drink already.
And so your wife took that glass and did what with it?
Well, she turned away a little and drank it rather quickly, I think. And then we walked a little way along the corridor looking at some of the pictures and the curtains. Lovely curtain stuff it was, like nothing we'd seen before. Then I met a pal of mine, Councillor Alcock, and I was just passing the time of day with him when I looked round and saw Heather was sitting on a chair looking rather odd. So I came to her and I said, what's the matter? She said she felt a little queer.
What kind of queerness?
I don't know, sir. I didn't have time. Her voice sounded very queer and thick, and her head was rolling a little. All of a sudden she made a great half gasp, and her head fell forward. She was dead, sir. Dead.
Chapter 8. St. Marymead, you say? Chief Inspector Craddock looked up sharply. The Assistant Commissioner was a little surprised. Yes, he said. St. Marymead. Why? Does it...
Nothing, really, said Dermot Craddock.
It's quite a small place, I understand, went on the other. Though, of course, there's a great deal of building development going on there now. practically all the way from St. Mary Mead to Much Benham, I understand. Hellingforth Studios, he added, are on the other side of St. Mary Mead, towards Market Basing. He was still looking slightly inquiring. Dermot Craddock felt that he should perhaps explain. I know someone living there, he said, at St. Mary Mead. An old lady. Very old lady by now. Perhaps she's dead, I don't know. But if not... The assistant commissioner took his subordinate's point, or at any rate he thought he did. Yes, he said. It would give you an in, in a way. One needs a bit of local gossip. The whole thing is a curious business. The county have called us in? Dermot asked. Yes, I've got the chief constable's letter here. They don't seem to feel that it's necessarily a local affair. The largest house in the neighbourhood, Gossington Hall, was recently sold as a residence for Marina Gregg, the film star, and her husband. They're shooting a film at their new studios at Hellingforth, in which she is starring. A fete was held in the grounds in aid of the St. John Ambulance. The dead woman, her name is Mrs. Heather Badcock, was the local secretary of this, and had done most of the administrative work for the fete. She seems to have been a competent, sensible person, well-liked locally. One of those bossy women, suggested Craddock. Very possibly, said the assistant commissioner. Still, in my experience, bossy women seldom get themselves murdered. I can't think why not. When you come to think of it, it's rather a pity. There was a record attendance at the fete, it seems. Good weather, everything running to plan. Marina Gregg and her husband held a kind of small private reception in Gossington Hall. About 30 or 40 people attended this. The local notables, various people connected with the St. John Ambulance Association... Several friends of Marina Gregg herself, and a few people connected to the studios. All very peaceful, nice, and happy. But, fantastically and improbably, Heather Badcock was poisoned there. Dermot Craddock said thoughtfully, "An odd place to choose." That's the chief constable's point of view. If anyone wanted to poison Heather Badcock, why choose that particular afternoon and circumstances? Hundreds of much simpler ways of doing it. A risky business anyway, you know, to slip a dose of deadly poison into a cocktail in the middle of 20 or 30 people milling about. Somebody ought to have seen something. It definitely was in the drink. Yes, it was definitely in the drink. We have the particulars here. One of those inexplicable names that doctors delight in, but actually a fairly common prescription in America. In America? I see. Oh, this country too. But these things are handed out much more freely on the other side of the Atlantic. Taken in small doses, beneficial. Supplied on prescription, or can it be bought freely? You have to have a prescription. Yes, it's odd, said Dermot. Heather Badcock have any connection with these film people? None whatever. Any member of her own family at this do? Her husband? Her husband, said Dermot thoughtfully. Yes, one always thinks that way, agreed his superior officer. But the local man, Cornish, I think his name is, doesn't seem to think there's anything in that, although he does report that Badcock seemed ill at ease and nervous. But he agrees that respectable people often are like that when interviewed by the police. They appear to have been quite a devoted couple. In other words, the police there don't think it's their pigeon. Well, it ought to be interesting. I take it I'm going down there, sir. Yes. Better get there as soon as possible, Dermot. Who do you want with you?
Dermot considered for a moment or two. Tiddler, I think, he said thoughtfully. He's a good man, and what's more, he's a film fan. That might come in useful.
The assistant commissioner nodded. Good luck to you, he said.
Well, exclaimed Miss Marple, going pink with pleasure and surprise, this is a surprise. How are you, my dear boy? Though you're hardly a boy now. What are you, a chief inspector, or this new thing they call a commander?
Dermot explained his present rank.
I suppose I need hardly ask what you are doing down here, said Miss Marple. Our local murder is considered worthy of the attention of Scotland Yard.
They handed it over to us, said Dermot, and so, naturally, as soon as I got down here, I came to headquarters.
Do you mean... Miss Marple fluttered a little.
Yes, Auntie, said Dermot disrespectfully. I mean you.
I'm afraid, said Miss Marple regretfully, I'm very much out of things nowadays. I don't get out much.
You get out enough to fall down and be picked up by a woman who's going to be murdered 10 days later, said Dermot Craddock. Miss Marple made the kind of noise that once would have been written down as tut-tut.
I don't know where you hear these things, she said.
You should know, said Dermot Craddock. You told me yourself that in a village everybody knows everything. And just off the record, he added, did you think she was going to be murdered as soon as you looked at her?
Of course not. Of course not, exclaimed Miss Marple. What an idea.
You didn't see that look in her husband's eye that reminded you of Harry Simpson or David Jones or somebody you've known years ago and subsequently pushed his wife off a precipice?
No, I did not, said Miss Marple. I'm sure Mr. Batcock would never do a wicked thing of that kind. At least, she added thoughtfully, I'm nearly sure.
But human nature being what it is, murmured Craddock wickedly.
Exactly, said Miss Marple. She added, I dare say after the first natural grief, he won't miss her very much.
Why? Did she bully him?
Oh, no, said Miss Marple, but I don't think that she... Well, she wasn't a considerate woman. Kind, yes. Considerate, no. She would be fond of him and look after him when he was ill and see to his meals and be a good housekeeper. But I don't think she would ever... Well, that she would ever even know what he might be feeling or thinking. That makes rather a lonely life for a man.
Ah, said Dermot, and is his life less likely to be lonely in the future?
I expect he'll marry again, said Miss Marple, perhaps quite soon. And probably, which is such a pity, a woman of much the same type. I mean... He'll marry someone with a stronger personality than his own.
Anyone in view? Asked Dermot.
Not that I know of, said Miss Marple.
She added regretfully,
but I know so little.
Well, what do you think? Urged Dermot Craddock. You've never been backward in thinking things.
I think, said Miss Marple unexpectedly, that you ought to go and see Mrs. Bantry.
Mrs. Bantry? Who is she? One of the film lot?
No, said Miss Marple. She lives in the East Lodge at Gossington. She was at the party that day. She used to own Gossington at one time, she and her husband, Colonel Bantry.
She was at the party, and she saw something?
I think she must tell you herself what it was she saw. You mayn't think it has any bearing on the matter, but I think it might be, just might be, suggestive. Tell her I sent you to her, and
Ah, yes. Perhaps you'd better just mention the Lady of Shalott.
Dermot Craddock looked at her with his head just slightly on one side. The Lady of Shalott, he said. Those are the code words, are they?
I don't know that I should put it that way, said Miss Marple. But it will remind her of what I mean.
Dermot Craddock got up. I shall be back, he warned her.
That's very nice of you, said Miss Marple. Perhaps, if you have time, you would come and have tea with me one day. If you still drink tea, she added rather wistfully. I know that so many young people nowadays only go out to drinks and things. They think that afternoon tea is a very outmoded affair.
I'm not as young as all that, said Dermot Craddock. Yes, I'll come and have tea with you one day. We'll have tea and gossip and talk about the village. Do you know any of the film stars, by the way, or any of the studio lot?
Not a thing, said Miss Marple, except what I hear, she added.
Well, you usually hear a good deal, said Dermot Craddock. Goodbye. It's been very nice to see you.
Oh, how do you do?
Said Mrs. Bantry, looking slightly taken aback when Dermot Craddock had introduced himself and explained who he was.
How very exciting to see you. Don't you always have sergeants with you?
I've got a sergeant down here, yes, said Craddock, but he's busy.
On routine inquiries? Asked Mrs. Bantry hopefully.
Something of the kind, said Dermot gravely.
And Jane Marple sent you to me, said Mrs. Bantry,
as she ushered him into her small sitting room.
I was just arranging some flowers, she explained. It's one of those days when flowers won't do anything you want them to do. They fall out, or stick up where they shouldn't stick up, or won't lie down where you want them to lie down. So I'm thankful to have a distraction, and especially such an exciting one. So, it really was murder, was it?
Did you think it was murder?
Well, it could have been an accident, I suppose, said Mrs. Bantry. Nobody said anything definite, officially, that is. Just that rather silly piece about no evidence to show by whom or in what way the poison was administered. But, of course, we all talk about it as murder.
And about who did it?
That's the odd part of it, said Mrs. Bantry. We don't. Because I really don't see who can have done it.
You mean, as a matter of definite physical fact, you don't see who could have done it?
Well, no, not that. I suppose it would have been difficult, but not impossible. No, I mean, I don't see who could have wanted to do it.
Nobody, you think, could have wanted to kill Heather Badcock?
Well, frankly, said Mrs. Bantry, I can't imagine anybody wanting to kill Heather Badcock. I've seen her quite a few times on local things, you know, girl guides and the St. John ambulance and various parish things. I found her rather a trying sort of woman. Very enthusiastic about everything and a bit given to overstatement and just a little bit of a gusher. But you don't want to murder people for that. She was the kind of woman who, in the old days, if you'd seen her approaching the front door, you'd have hurried out to say to your parlour maid, which was an institution we had in those days, and very useful too, and told her to say not at home, or not at home to visitors, if she had conscientious scruples about the truth.
You mean that one might take pains to avoid Mrs. Badcock, but one would have no urge to remove her permanently?
Very well put,
said Mrs. Bantry, nodding approval. She had no money to speak of, mused Dermot, so nobody stood to gain by her death. Nobody seems to have disliked her to the point of hatred. I don't suppose she was blackmailing anybody.
She wouldn't have dreamed of doing such a thing, I'm sure, said Mrs. Bantry. She was the conscientious, high-principled kind.
And her husband wasn't having an affair with someone else?
I shouldn't think so, said Mrs. Bantry. I only saw him at the party. He looked like a bit of chewed string. Nice, but wet.
"Doesn't leave much, does it?" said Dermot Craddock. "One falls back on the assumption she knew something."
"Knew something?"
"To the detriment of somebody else."
Mrs. Bantry shook her head again. "I doubt it," she said. "I doubt it very much. She struck me as the kind of woman who, if she had known anything about anyone, couldn't have helped talking about it."
"Well, that washes that out," said Dermot Craddock. "So we'll come, if we may, to my reasons for coming to see you. Miss Marple, for whom I have the greatest admiration and respect, told me that I was to say to you, 'The Lady of Shalott.'"
"Oh, that," said Mrs. Bantry.
"Yes," said Craddock, "that, whatever it is."
"People don't read much Tennyson nowadays," said Mrs. Bantry.
"A few echoes come back to me," said Dermot Craddock. "She looked out to Camelot, didn't she? Out flew the web and floated wide, the mirror cracked from side to side, the curse has come upon me," cried the Lady of Shalott.
"Exactly."
"She did," said Mrs. Bantry.
"I beg your pardon?
Who did?
Did what?"
"Looked like that," said Mrs. Bantry.
"Who looked like what?"
"Marina Gregg."
"Ah, Marina Gregg. When was this?"
"Well, didn't Jane Marple tell you?"
"She didn't tell me anything. She sent me to you."
"That's tiresome of her," said Mrs. Bantry, "because she can always tell things better than I can. My husband always used to say that I was so abrupt that he didn't know what I was talking about. Anyway, it may have been only my fancy. But when you see anyone looking like that, you can't help remembering it."
"Please tell me," said Dermot Craddock.
"Well, it was at the party. I call it a party because what can one call things? But it was just a sort of reception up at the top of the stairs where they've made a kind of recess. Marina Gregg was there, and her husband. They fetched some of us in. They fetched me, I suppose, because I once owned the house. And they fetched Heather Badcock and her husband because she'd done all the running of the fete and the arrangements. And we happened to go up the stairs at about the same time. So I was standing there, you see, when I noticed it."
"Quite. When you noticed what?"
"Well, Mrs. Badcock went into a long spiel, as people do when they meet celebrities. You know, how wonderful it was, and what a thrill, and they'd always hoped to see them. And she went into a long story of how she'd once met her, years ago, and how exciting it had been. And I thought in my own mind, you know, what a bore it must be for these poor celebrities to have to say all the right things. And then I noticed that Marina Gregg wasn't saying all the right things. She was just staring."
"Staring at Mrs. Badcock?"
"No. No, it looked as though she'd forgotten Mrs. Badcock altogether. I mean, I don't believe she'd even heard what Mrs. Badcock was saying. She was just staring with what I call this Lady of Shalott look. As though she'd seen something awful. Something frightening. Something she could hardly believe she saw, and couldn't bear to see."
"The curse has come upon me?" suggested Dermot Craddock.
"Yes. Just that.
That's why I call it the Lady of Shalott look."
"But what was she looking at, Mrs. Bantry?"
"Well, I wish I knew," said Mrs. Bantry.
"She was at the top of the stairs, you say?"
"She was looking over Mrs. Badcock's head. No, more over one shoulder, I think."
"Straight at the middle of the staircase?"
"It might have been a little to one side."
"And there were people coming up the staircase?"
"Oh, yes. I should think about 5 or 6 people."
"Was she looking at one of these people in particular?"
"But I can't possibly tell," said Mrs. Bantry. "You see, I wasn't facing that way. I was looking at her. My back was to the stairs."
I thought perhaps she was looking at one of the pictures. But she must know the pictures quite well if she's living in the house.
Yes, yes, of course.
No, I suppose she must have been looking at one of the people. I wonder which.
We have to try and find out, said Dermot Craddock. Can you remember at all who the people were?
Well, I know the mayor was one of them with his wife. There was someone who I think was a reporter with red hair, because I was introduced to him later, but I can't remember his name. I never hear names. Galbraith, something like that. Then there was a big black man. I don't mean a negro, I just mean very dark, forceful-looking. And an actress with him, a bit over blonde and the minky kind. And old General Barnstaple from Much Benham. He's practically gaga now, poor old boy. I don't think he could have been anybody's doom. Oh, and the Grices from the farm. Those are all the people you can remember.
Well, there may have been others, but you see, I wasn't... Well, I mean, I wasn't noticing particularly.
I know that the mayor and General Barnstaple and the Americans did arrive about that time, and there were people taking photographs. One, I think, was a local man, and there was a girl from London, an arty-looking girl with long hair and a rather large camera.
And you think it was one of those people who brought that look to Marina Gregg's face?
Well, I didn't really think anything, said Mrs. Bantry with complete frankness. I just wondered what on earth made her look like that. And then I didn't think of it any more. But afterwards one remembers about these things. But of course, added Mrs. Bantry with honesty, I may have imagined it. After all, she may have had a sudden toothache or a safety pin run into her or sudden violent colic. The sort of thing where you try to go on as usual and not to show anything, but your face can't help looking awful.
Dermot Craddock laughed. I'm glad to see you're a realist, Mrs. Bantry, he said. As you say, it may have been something of that kind. But it's certainly just one interesting little fact that might be a pointer. He shook his head and departed to present his official credentials in Much Benham.
Chapter 9.
So, locally you've drawn a blank, said Craddock, offering his cigarette case to Frank Cornish.
Completely, said Cornish. No enemies, no quarrels, on good terms with her husband.
No question of another woman or another man?
The other shook his head.
Nothing of that kind.
No hint of scandal anywhere.
She wasn't what you call the sexy kind. She was on a lot of committees and things like that, and there were some small local rivalries, but nothing beyond that.
There wasn't anyone else the husband wanted to marry. No one in the office where he worked.
He's in Biddle and Russell, the estate agents and valuers. This Florrie West with adenoids, and Miss Grundle, who is at least 50 and as plain as a haystack. Nothing much there to excite a man. Though, for all that, I shouldn't be surprised if he did marry again soon.
Craddock looked interested.
A neighbour, explained Cornish, a widow. When I went back with him from the inquest, she'd gone in and was making him tea and looking after him generally. He seemed surprised and grateful. If you ask me, she's made up her mind to marry him, but he doesn't know it yet, poor chap.
What sort of woman is she?
Good-looking, admitted the other. Not young, but handsome in a gypsyish sort of way. High colour, dark eyes.
What's her name?
Bain, Mrs. Mary Bain. She's a widow.
What did her husband do?
No idea. She's got a son working near here who lives with her. She seems a quiet, respectable woman. All the same, I've a feeling I've seen her before.
He looked at his watch.
10 to 12. I've made an appointment for you at Gossington Hall at 12 o'clock. We'd best be going.
Dermot Craddock's eyes, which always looked gently inattentive,
were in actuality making a close mental note of the features of Gossington Hall. Inspector Cornish had taken him there, had delivered him over to a young man called Haley Preston, and had then taken a tactful leave. Since then, Dermot Craddock had been gently nodding at Mr. Preston. Haley Preston, he gathered, was a kind of public relations or personal assistant or private secretary, or more likely a mixture of all three, to Jason Rudd. He talked. He talked freely and at length, without much modulation, and managing miraculously not to repeat himself too often. He was a pleasant young man, anxious that his own views, reminiscent of those of Dr. Pangloss, that all was for the best in the best of all possible worlds, should be shared by anyone in whose company he happened to be. He said several times, and in different ways, what a terrible shame this had been, how worried everyone had been, how Marina was absolutely prostrated, how Mr. Rudd was more upset than he could possibly say, how it absolutely beat anything that a thing like that should happen, didn't it? Possibly there might have been some kind of allergy to some particular kind of substance. He just put that forward as an idea. Allergies were extraordinary things. Chief Inspector Craddock was to count on every possible cooperation that Hellingforth Studios or any of their staff could give. He was to ask any questions he wanted, go anywhere he liked. If they could help in any way, they would do so. They all had had the greatest respect for Mrs. Badcock and appreciated her strong social sense and the valuable work she had done for the St. John Ambulance Association. He then started again, not in the same words, but using the same motifs. No one could have been more eagerly cooperative. At the same time, he endeavoured to convey how very far this was from the cellophane world of studios, and Mr. Jason Rudd and Miss Marina Gregg, or any of the people in the house who surely were going to do their utmost to help in any way they possibly could. Then he nodded gently some 44 times. Dermot Craddock took advantage of the pause to say, "Thank you very much." It was said quietly, but with a kind of finality that brought Mr. Haley Preston up with a jerk. He said, "Well," and paused inquiringly. "You said I might ask questions?" "Sure, sure, if I had." "Is this the place where she died?"
"Mrs. Badcock?"
"Mrs. Badcock, is this the place?"
"Yes, sure, right here. At least, well, actually, I can show you the chair."
They were standing on the landing recess. Haley Preston walked a short way along the corridor and pointed out a rather phony-looking oak armchair.
"She was sitting right there," he said. "She said she didn't feel well. Someone went to get her something, and then she just died right there."
"I see."
"I don't know if she'd seen a physician lately, if she'd been warned that she had anything wrong with her heart."
"She had nothing wrong with her heart," said Dermot Craddock. "She was a healthy woman. She died of 6 times the maximum dose of a substance whose official name I will not try to pronounce, but which I understand is generally known as Calmo."
"Oh, I know," said Haley Preston. "I take it myself sometimes."
"Indeed? That's very interesting. You find it has a good effect?"
"Marvellous, marvellous. It bucks you up and it soothes you down, if you understand what I mean. Naturally," he added, "you would have to take it in the proper dosage."
"Would there be supplies of this substance in the house?" He knew the answer to the question, but he put it as though he did not. Haley Preston's answer was frankness itself.
"Loads of it, I should say. There'll be a bottle of it in most of the bathroom cupboards here."
"Which doesn't make our task easier."
"Of course," said Haley Preston, "she might have used the stuff herself and taken a dose and, as I say, had an allergy."
Craddock looked unconvinced. Haley Preston sighed and said,
"You're quite definite about the dosage."
"Oh, yes, It was a lethal dose, and Mrs. Badcock did not take any such things herself. As far as we can make out, the only things she ever took were bicarbonate of soda or aspirin. Haley Preston shook his head and said, "That sure gives us a problem."
"Yes, it sure does." "Where did Mr. Rudd and Miss Gregg receive their guests?"
"Right here." Haley Preston went to the spot at the top of the stairs. Chief Inspector Craddock stood beside him. He looked at the wall opposite him. In the centre was an Italian Madonna and Child. A good copy, he presumed, of some well-known picture. The blue-robed Madonna held aloft the infant Jesus, and both Child and Mother were laughing. Little groups of people stood on either side, their eyes upraised to the Child. One of the more pleasing Madonnas, Dermot Craddock thought. To the right and left of this picture were two narrow windows. The whole effect was very charming, but it seemed to him that there was emphatically nothing there that would cause a woman to look like the Lady of Shalott whose doom had come upon her. "People, of course, were coming up the stairs?" he asked.
"Yes, they came in driblets, you know, not too many at once. I shepherded up some. Ella Zielinski, that's Mr. Rudd's secretary, brought some of the others. We wanted to make it all pleasant and informal."
"Were you here yourself at the time Mrs. Badcock came up?"
"I'm ashamed to tell you, Chief Inspector Craddock, that I just can't remember. I had a list of names. I went out and I shepherded people in. I introduced them, sorted drinks. Then I'd go out and come up with the next batch. At the time, I didn't know this Mrs. Badcock by sight, and she wasn't one of the ones on my list to bring up."
"What about Mrs. Bantry?"
"Ah, yes. She's the former owner of this place, isn't she?" "I believe she and Mrs. Badcock and her husband did come up about the same time." He paused. "And the mayor came just about then. He had a big chain on, and a wife with yellow hair wearing royal blue with frills. I remember all of them. I didn't pour drinks for any of them, because I had to go down and bring up the next lot."
"Who did pour drinks for them?"
"Why, I can't exactly say. There were three or four of us on duty. I know I went down the stairs just as the mayor was coming up."
"Who else was on the stairs as you went down, if you can remember?"
Jim Galbraith, one of the newspaper boys who was covering this. Three or four others whom I didn't know. There were a couple of photographers, one of the locals, I don't remember his name, and an arty girl from London who rather specializes in queer angle shots. Her camera was set right up in that corner so that she could get a view of Miss Gregg receiving. Now, let me think. I rather fancy that that was when Ardwick Fenn arrived.
And who is Ardwick Fenn?"
Haley Preston looked shocked. "He's a big shot, Chief Inspector. A very big shot in the television and moving picture world. We didn't even know he was in this country."
"His turning up was a surprise?"
"I'll say it was," said Preston. "Nice of him to come, and quite unexpected."
"Was he an old friend of Miss Gregg's and Mr. Rudd's?"
"He was an old friend of Marina's a good many years ago when she was married to her second husband. I don't know how well Jason knew him.
Anyway, it was a pleasant surprise when he arrived."
"Sure it was. We were all delighted."
Craddock nodded and passed from that to other subjects. He made meticulous inquiries about the drinks, their ingredients, how they were served, who served them, what servants and hired servants were on duty. The answers seemed to be, as Inspector Cornish had already hinted, was the case that, although any one of 30 people could have poisoned Heather Badcock with the utmost ease, yet at the same time any one of the 30 might have been seen doing so. It was, Craddock reflected, a big chance to take. "Thank you," he said at last. "Now I would like, if I may, to speak to Miss Marina Gregg."
Haley Preston shook his head.
"I'm sorry," he said.
I really am sorry, but that's right out of the question.
Craddock's eyebrows rose.
Surely. She's prostrated. She's absolutely prostrated. She's got her own physician here looking after her. He wrote out a certificate. I've got it here. I'll show it you.
Craddock took it and read it.
I see, he said. He asked, does Marina Gregg always have a physician in attendance?
They're very high-strung, all these actors and actresses. It's a big strain, this life. It's usually considered desirable in the case of the big shots that they should have a physician who understands their constitution and their nerves. Morris Gilchrist has a very big reputation. He's looked after Miss Gregg for many years now. She's had a great deal of illness, as you may have read, in the last 4 years. She was hospitalized for a very long time. It's only about a year ago that she got her strength and health back.
I see.
Haley Preston seemed relieved that Craddock was not making any more protests.
You'll want to see Mr. Rudd, he suggested.
He looked at his watch. He'll be back from the studios in about 10 minutes, if that's all right for you.
That'll do admirably, said Craddock. In the meantime, is Dr. Gilchrist in the house?
He is.
Then I'd like to talk to him.
Why, certainly. I'll fetch him right away.
The young man bustled away. Dermot Craddock stood thoughtfully at the top of the stairs. Of course, this frozen look that Mrs. Bantry had described might have been entirely Mrs. Bantry's imagination. She was, he thought, a woman who would jump to conclusions. At the same time, he thought it quite likely that the conclusion to which she had jumped was a just one. Without going so far as to look like the Lady of Shalott seeing doom coming down upon her, Marina Gregg might have seen something that vexed or annoyed her. Something that had caused her to have been negligent to a guest to whom she was talking. Somebody had come up those stairs, perhaps, who could be described as an unexpected guest, an unwelcome guest. He turned at the sound of footsteps. Haley Preston was back, and with him was Dr. Morris Gilchrist. Dr. Gilchrist was not at all as Dermot Craddock had imagined him. He had no suave bedside manner, neither was he theatrical in appearance. He seemed, on the face of it, a blunt, hearty, matter-of-fact man. He was dressed in tweeds, slightly florid tweeds to the English idea. He had a thatch of brown hair and observant, keen, dark eyes. Dr. Gilchrist?
I am Chief Inspector Dermot Craddock. May I have a word or two with you in private?
The doctor nodded. He turned along the corridor and went along it almost to the end. Then he pushed the door open and invited Craddock to enter.
No one will disturb us here, he said.
It was obviously the doctor's own bedroom, a very comfortably appointed one. Dr. Gilchrist indicated a chair and then sat down himself.
I understand, said Craddock, that Miss Marina Gregg, according to you, is unable to be interviewed.
What's the matter with her, Doctor?
Gilchrist shrugged his shoulders very slightly.
Nerves, he said.
If you were to ask her questions now, she'd be in a state bordering on hysteria within 10 minutes. I can't permit that. If you like to send your police doctor to see me, I'd be willing to give him my views. She was unable to be present at the inquest for the same reason.
How long, asked Craddock, is such a state of things likely to continue?
Dr. Gilchrist looked at him and smiled. It was a likable smile. If you want my opinion, he said, a human opinion, that is, not a medical one, any time within the next 48 hours, and she'll be not only willing but asking to see you. She'll be wanting to ask questions. She'll be wanting to answer your questions. They're like that.
He leaned forward. I'd like to try and make you understand, if I can, Chief Inspector, a little bit what makes these people act the way they do. The motion picture life is a life of continuous strain. and the more successful you are, the greater the strain. You live always, all day, in the public eye. When you're on location, when you're working, it's hard, monotonous work with long hours. You're there in the morning, you sit, and you wait. You do your small bit, the bit that's being shot over and over again. If you're rehearsing on the stage, you'd be rehearsing as likely as not a whole act, or at any rate a part of an act. The thing would be in sequence. It would be more or less human and credible. But when you're shooting a picture, everything's taken out of sequence. It's a monotonous, grinding business. It's exhausting. You live in luxury, of course. You have soothing drugs. You have baths and creams and powders and medical attention. You have relaxations and parties and people. But you're always in the public eye. You can't enjoy yourself quietly. You can't really ever relax. I can understand that, said Dermot. Yes, I can understand. And there's another thing, went on Gilchrist. If you adopt this career, and especially if you're any good at it, you are a certain kind of person. You're a person, or so I've found in my experience, with a skin too few. A person who is plagued the whole time with diffidence, a terrible feeling of inadequacy, of apprehension that you can't do what's required of you. People say that actors and actresses are vain. That isn't true. They're not conceited about themselves. They're obsessed with themselves, yes. But they need reassurance the whole time. They must be continually reassured. Ask Jason Rudd. He'll tell you the same. You have to make them feel they can do it, to assure them they can do it. Take them over and over again, over the same thing, encouraging them the whole time until you get the effect you want. But they are always doubtful of themselves. And that makes them, in an ordinary human, unprofessional word, nervy. Damn nervy. A mass of nerves. And the worse their nerves are, the better they are at the job. That's interesting, said Craddock, very interesting. He paused, adding, though I don't quite see why you... I'm trying to make you understand Marina Gregg, said Maurice Gilchrist. You've seen her pictures, no doubt. She's a wonderful actress, said Dermot, wonderful. She has a personality, a beauty, a sympathy. Yes, said Gilchrist. She has all those, and she's had to work like the devil to produce the effects that she has produced. In the process, her nerves get shot to pieces, and she is not actually a strong woman physically, not as strong as you need to be. She's got one of those temperaments that swing to and fro between despair and rapture. She can't help it. She's made that way. She suffered a great deal in her life. A large part of the suffering has been her own fault, but some of it hasn't. None of her marriages has been happy, except, I'd say, this last one. She's married to a man now who loves her dearly and who's loved her for years. She's sheltering in that love, and she's happy in it. At least, at the moment, she's happy in it. One can't say how long all that will last. The trouble with her is that either she thinks that at last she's got to that spot or place or that moment in her life where everything's like a fairy tale come true, that nothing can go wrong, that she'll never be unhappy again, or else she's down in the dumps, a woman whose life is ruined, who's never known love and happiness, and who never will again. He added dryly, if she could only stop halfway between the two, it'd be wonderful for her. And the world would lose a fine actress. He paused, but Dermot Craddock did not speak. He was wondering why Maurice Gilchrist was saying what he did. Why this close, detailed analysis of Marina Gregg? Gilchrist was looking at him. It was as though he was urging Dermot to ask one particular question. Dermot wondered very much what the question was that he ought to ask. He said at last, slowly, with the air of one feeling his way, "She's been very much upset by this tragedy happening here."
"Yes," said Gilchrist, "she has."
"Almost unnaturally so?"
"That depends," said Dr. Gilchrist.
"On what does it depend?"
"On her reason for being so upset."
"I suppose," said Dermot, feeling his way, "that it was a shock, a sudden death happening like that in the midst of a party." He saw very little response in the face opposite him. "Or might it," he said, "be something more than that?"
"You can't tell, of course," said Dr. Gilchrist, "how people are going to react. You can't tell however well you know them. They can always surprise you. Marina might have taken this in her stride. She's a soft-hearted creature. She might say, 'Oh, poor, poor woman, how tragic. I wonder how it could have happened.' She could have been sympathetic without really caring. After all, deaths do occasionally occur at studio parties. Or she might, if there wasn't anything very interesting going on, choose unconsciously, mind you, to dramatize herself over it. She might decide to throw a scene. Or there might be some quite different reason." Dermot decided to take the bull by the horns. "I wish," he said, "you would tell me what you really think."
"I don't know," said Dr. Gilchrist. "I can't be sure." He paused, and then said, "There's professional etiquette, you know. There's the relationship between doctor and patient. She has told you something?"
"I don't think I could go as far as that."
"Did Marina Gregg know this woman, Heather Badcock? Had she met her before?"
"I don't think she knew her from Adam," said Dr. Gilchrist. "No, that's not the trouble. If you ask me, it's nothing to do with Heather Badcock."
Dermot said,
"This stuff, this Calmo, does Marina Gregg ever use it herself?"
"Lives on it pretty well," said Dr. Gilchrist. "So does everyone else around here," he added. "Ella Zielinski takes it. Haley Preston takes it. Half a Boiling takes it. It's the fashion at this moment. They're all much the same, these things. People get tired of one, and they try a new one that comes out, and they think it's wonderful, and that it makes all the difference."
"And does it make all the difference?"
"Well," said Gilchrist, "it makes a difference. It does its work. It calms you, or it peps you up. Makes you feel you could do things which otherwise you might fancy that you couldn't. I don't prescribe them more than I can help, but they're not dangerous, taken properly.
They help people who can't help themselves."
"I wish I knew," said Dermot Craddock, "what it is that you are trying to tell me."
"I'm trying to decide," said Gilchrist, "what is my duty. There are two duties. There's the duty of a doctor to his patient.
What his patient says to him is confidential and must be kept so.
But there's another point of view. You can fancy that there is a danger to a patient. You have to take steps to avoid that danger." He stopped. Craddock looked at him and waited.
"Yes," said Dr. Gilchrist.
I think I know what I must do. I must ask you, Chief Inspector Craddock, to keep what I am telling you confidential. Not from your colleagues, of course, but as far as regards the outer world, particularly in the house here. Do you agree? I can't bind myself, said Craddock. I don't know what will arise. In general terms, yes, I agree. That is to say, I imagine that any piece of information you gave me I should prefer to keep to myself and my colleagues. Now, listen, said Gilchrist. This mayn't mean anything at all. Women say anything when they're in the state of nerves Marina Gregg is now. I'm telling you something she said to me. There may be nothing in it at all. What did she say? Asked Craddock. She broke down after this thing happened. She sent for me. I gave her a sedative. I stayed there beside her, holding her hand, telling her to calm down, telling her things were going to be all right. Then, just before she went off into unconsciousness, she said, "It was meant for me, Doctor." Craddock stared. She said that, did she? And afterwards? The next day? She never alluded to it again. I raised the point once. She evaded it. She said, "Oh, you must have made a mistake. I'm sure I never said anything like that. I expect I was half-doped at the time." But do you think she meant it? She meant it all right, said Gilchrist. That's not to say that it is so, he added warningly. Whether someone meant to poison her or meant to poison Heather Badcock, I don't know. You'd probably know better than I would. All I do say is that Marina Gregg definitely thought and believed that that dose was meant for her. Craddock was silent for some moments. Then he said, "Thank you, Dr. Gilchrist. I appreciate what you have told me, and I realize your motive. If what Marina Gregg said to you was founded on fact, it may mean, may it not, that there is still a danger to her?" "That's the point," said Gilchrist. "That's the whole point." "Have you any reason to believe that that might be so?" "No, I haven't." "No idea what her reason for thinking so was?" "No." "Thank you." Craddock got up. "Just one more thing, Doctor. Do you know if she said the same thing to her husband?" Slowly Gilchrist shook his head. "No," he said. "I'm quite sure of that. She didn't tell her husband." His eyes met Dermot's for a few moments. Then he gave a brief nod of his head and said, "You don't want me any more? All right, I'll go back and have a look at the patient. You shall talk to her as soon as it's possible." He left the room, and Craddock remained, pursing his lips up and whistling very softly beneath his breath. End of Disc 3.